Hi, I'm Chris Cotnor, executive producer of the DSR Network. We've been incredibly busy here over the past month. With the launch of TNR's Daily Blast, we now produce 10 shows covering foreign policy, national security, domestic politics, cyber and tech, legal, and much more. We've also just launched our redesigned website at thedsrnetwork.com. With all this content, there has never been a better time to become a member. Members receive an ad-free listening experience, bonus content for nearly all of our shows, early access to episodes, enhanced show notes, and access to our exclusive DSR Slack community. Membership is just $7 per month or $70 per year. To become a member, please visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy. Thank you very much for your support.
Welcome to The Secret Life of Cookies, where we try to solve the world's problems through the miracle of carbohydrates, one recipe at a time, with host Marissa Rothkopf and her dog, Bosco.
Hello, hello, everyone, or for those who have been watching the fun Mr. and Mrs. Smith remake with Donald Glover and Maya Erskine, should I say hi, hi? Anyway, thank you for patiently waiting for this latest episode, but we shall be on a regular schedule going forward, one hopes. My guest today is one of my favorite humans, Rachel Vindman. We take apart all the news of the week. And much of it we put back together better, I tell you, than how we found it. But before we get to the good stuff, a kind request to please leave a review in the Apple Podcast Store. The reason all of us podcasters are always requesting this of you is because it really does help our profile. This podcast, for instance, is buried under a pile of other political podcasts. And so it's hard for people to necessarily find it unless they're smart like you guys. So help them out, please, and leave a review in the Apple Podcast Store. And I will be eternally grateful for you and will send you locks of Bosco's hair if you wish. Just kidding. Well, unless you really want it. Anyway, here we go. While I did not get to cook in this week's episode, this week's newsletter at marissarothkopf.substack.com is all about the history of cream cheese, bagels, and lox, and has a spiffy recipe, if I do say so myself, for a creamy spinach and artichoke casserole. And please, don't forget to join Deep State Radio as a member for special perks. Either way, I am grateful for your support. Just a warning, there is a mention of suicide at the end of this episode. And now to Rachel. And welcome to Riverside and to everybody who is here listening to The Secret Life of Cookies. It's been a little bit since my last episode. A lot of craziness is going on. So I apologize to all those people who wait patiently, as I'm sure they do, by their little podcast delivery box going, when? Well, here we are. And what better way to get better.
Here we are.
And better than by having Ms. Rachel Vindman on as my guest. Thank you so much for taking some time out of this early March. What day is today? I have no idea. Is it like the 7th or something?
It's the 7th.
I told you it's been crazy. Welcome. How have you been?
I have been well, busy, as we all are these days. But, you know, well, I feel like this week has been a little bit particularly crazy. I can thank having a 13-year-old for that and trying to sell a house that we've owned for a while. We no longer want to own it. And it is all very challenging. So it's been one of those weeks, like nothing bad, just like
right.
Some like minor crisis every day, or like two or three. And yeah, but I've resigned myself. Yes, I was like, maybe today will be better, and it wasn't. So I'm just, the whole week is just going to be like this, and I've accepted it. I think I've gotten to that point where.
Second. I mean, when I ask the question, I'm not asking it like, let's say, our friend in government, Elise Stefanik, who asked the priceless question today, a question that even when this podcast comes out in two days or so, will wonder, let me ask you, Ms. Binman, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? Who asks that question anymore?
I mean, I think she could have picked any 2 week period in the past 3 decades to ask about rather than this one. Like, no one is better off. I mean, unless you were like maybe have like some sort of terminal disease and then you got a reprieve and they were like, oh, sorry, those weren't actually the results. Or I don't know. I mean, it would have to be a very extreme circumstance because 4 years ago today, I mean, me personally, my husband had just was less than a month out from being fired from the White House. We had no idea what we were going to do, how we were going to afford like kind of a forced retirement from him and what he was going to do, where we were going to live, lots of questions. And just as like there seemed to be some possibilities, there was this virus that everyone was talking about. And then the whole world shut down. And yeah, so, and then everything went from like pretty bad to a lot worse. And I've learned a lot about PTSD through the past 4 years, Ms. Stefanik. And I would say, you know, one of the things that's interesting about it, I mentioned it to someone who actually has significant PTSD, and he said, I said, you know, I know I need to deal with what I've been through for the past 4 years, but I don't want to because I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to revisit those times. And he said, that was PTSD. And I was like, oh, okay. Well, still not ready. But, you know, but I do think it is very hard to deal with things in our life. And I have a whole new appreciation for people who don't want to do that because of how challenging it is. But if she thinks that we're going to forget that we do not remember because we don't want to remember, that is not the case. And as painful as the first Trump presidency was, we will not hesitate to bring up all those uncomfortable and horrible moments just to remind people who have locked it up for their own mental health.
One thing I can say positively, I mean, I could probably say more than one thing, but one positive thing about the current Biden-Harris campaign, as far as I'm concerned, is their willingness to bring attention to the slurring of words, the absurdities that come flitting out of, or I mean, demented absurdities, as far as I'm concerned. His brain is not where it should be or was even. And by him, I mean Trump. As somebody said, Joe Biden's brain is old. Donald Trump's is demented. And like in a clinical way, demented. So I'm pleased that the Biden-Harris camp is actually bringing attention to these things and reminding people. So if anything, we can send them to the people who still aren't convinced, because someday, maybe. Speaking of someday, you now not only are the part of the Suburban Women Problem podcast, but you also are writing a Substack. And for those people out there who don't know what a Substack is, why aren't you subscribed to both of ours? But come on.
Yeah.
But it's a newsletter kind of that is delivered, and yours is superb. And a number of yours this week, past week, really stood out to me. And one was, and I'm quoting you, so look like you said this, because remember, I will save my daydreaming for visions of what our country will look like when we are no longer living with the looming threat of authoritarianism. You said this is not a time for daydreaming. And what provoked you? Oh, just because.
I am really tired of these clickbait stories that we are going to not have Joe Biden as the Democratic nominee. And actually, for a while, I think there was maybe some segment of the Republican, still people who identify as Republicans, and some independents who also thought that Trump wouldn't be the nominee.
Right.
But they thought that it was not going to be a Biden-Trump rematch. And this, I have it on authority. I don't speak to like big donors, but my husband does, and he works with people who do. And, you know, I I happen to know that there's a lot of people in denial about whether or not it would be a Trump-Biden rematch, which is just, you know, breathtaking to me. Because for one really basic reason is Joe Biden has raised a lot of money of campaign funds. Mm-hmm. So even if like his political action committee fund, which I think is like Biden Victory Fund, or I don't know what it's called, but that is where I know. You guys don't like it. I don't like it either. People can give very large amounts of money, like more than my house. And and they can give, you know, unlimited amounts of money. Those funds can transfer to another candidate, but it's limited on what those funds can be used for. And, you know, you still have to have campaign dollars, and there is a limit on those campaign dollars that you can give to an individual candidate. But those are a lot more use. I'm utilitarian, I guess. They can just go for a lot more things that PAC money can't be spent on.
Right.
And those funds are very important, and they cannot be transferred to someone else, to another candidate. So let's say that your dream that, not your dream, but someone's dream of, you know, of this like hypothetical scenario is it's just not going to happen. And thinking that it might is not helpful. And I hesitate to use a lot of analogies that come to mind because I feel like that then it kind of points like the choice in a really negative light. And that's not what I intend to do, but we just need to accept that this is the way it is. And, you know, Joe Biden, whether you're happy about it or not happy about it or somewhere in the middle, is going to be the nominee. And like, stop thinking that it's going to be something else, that you're just going to be so excited because all of a sudden it's going to be Gretchen Whitmer or Gavin Newsom, or, and by the way, all these people also have faults. Okay. Let's not put someone on a pedestal because they're human, just like you and I are.
Mm. Oh, well, speak for yourself, but yes.
It is now. Yeah, I know if it's true, but now is not the time to engage in this. What we need to be doing is, I think, twofold. This is where I kind of think the current administration and whatever the campaign is getting a little bit wrong right now, because I do have a marketing background. And so like, if I'm like, oh, Marissa, remember when you used that flour, how great that flour was? That flour was amazing, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. It was so good when you made those cookies 2 weeks ago. No. What I need to say, Marissa, I know you bought this before, but you need to use that flour again. If you use that flour again and this recipe or this recipe, it is going to be incredible. Your challah on Friday night is going to be life-changing. When you make a cake to take to your coffee morning on Monday, it's going to be great if you use that flour in the future so you have something to look forward to.
I think that's exactly right. And speaking of looking forward, we should look forward. I mean, we should gaze forward because looking forward sounds like we're eagerly awaiting it. But we should look in, look into the future and see that that is a that is the outcome if we have Donald Trump as the winner. So looking forward has positives, and it has a reminder, a very sharp reminder that if we don't look forward, it's all over. As far as a democracy is concerned. And that's such a good point about looking forward. Especially when, if you're going to write your marketing thesis right now, especially when you have two old gentlemen in office and our stereotype of old folks is, oh, do you remember when? And no one's more famous for that than old Joe from Scranton, you know? So looking forward to our future, talking about what it means, what he can do to improve the lives of his grandchildren, say, you know, that's the positive. Like really, if your grandpa can do that sort of stuff, awesome. And maybe, just maybe, it will engage young people to hear that somebody old is looking out for them. Because, you know, it can't all rest on the shoulders of Kamala Harris, who is amazing and has fantastic shoulders and is doing amazing work. And I just wish more people paid attention to it. But that's me.
I'm going to say, I had a friend, a good friend that I love, was very upset about the vice president's comments about Israel this week. Mm. I think Israel is very important to both you and I. Mm-hmm. So the thing is there's a lot of space here for a lot of different feelings and a lot of different thoughts. And she can have her own thoughts and feelings. Nothing has to be walked back. I realize she is the vice president of the United States, but she can also have policy views that may different from the president and his national security team. She also has her own national security team. She does not set policy, but she is free to share her opinions and what she would do. And I don't think what she did was egregious in any way. Mm-mm. And I had to kind of gently say that to my friend. And, you know, we have to, I think even amongst people with similar views, we have to have kind of these hard conversations sometimes, and that's okay.
I agree. And I also think that we also have to look at, once again, the country as a whole and look at most people under the age of 35 who have grown up in a different world for whom Israel is a different sort of vision. You know, their vision is more like, well, and I think we have to acknowledge all of those people and their points of view. And I think Kamala is good. It's good that's mentioned there in the administration at some point. So I'm pleased with that. I was just gonna pick on some words, as is my wont, before we go into some other, a few more deeper things. And one is Katie Porter pretending that she didn't use the word rig on purpose today. For those people who haven't been paying attention, she claimed that the reason she didn't win the Super Tuesday primary for a runoff for Senate in California was because it was rigged by billions of dollars of influencer money. And she's right. She's right in the sense that there is so much money in California, and so much money was given to Adam Schiff. And yes, that does influence how a election is, whether an election is won or lost.
Sure.
But of all the words, we have a dictionary in America full of words.
It's true.
Why would you choose the word rig unless you meant it? Especially anyone, especially on our side of the aisle, who has been sentient over the past 4 years.
I always wonder, is this something that the candidate or the office holder or someone has written, or is it someone from their team? I don't know. But regardless, whoever wrote it was experiencing a lot of big feelings at the moment. And I appreciate that. I mean, I have gotten caught up in the moment, both on real life and in social media from time to time. But we do have to be very careful. And I also am fairly sure that the polling showed it was always going to be a long shot for her, because like the internal polling that a campaign does is, especially in a primary, is a lot more accurate, because it's like very opt-in from Democrats and, you know, or either side, but they're really like drilling down on like, what do you want to hear? And it is really probably, I know that we talk about how polling is bad, but it's the most accurate polling in this climate that we can really have. And so I suspect that she kind of knew this. And then there's a lot of, you know, full disclosure, my husband did like send out some emails for fundraising for Adam Schiff. And I saw that the people were saying that Adam Schiff had some ads that were like saying good things about the Republican nominee, hoping that, because in California, I don't know if people know this, but it could have been, it's like kind of a jungle primary. So it could have been a situation where it was two Democrats against each other. And so the accusation was that
Adam Schiff was running ads so that he would not have to run against Katie Porter, that he would be able to run against Steve Garvey, who did end up winning. Right. The second number amount of votes. And so I was like, what? Like, this can't be right. So I'm like trying to find the video. I only saw people talking about it. I didn't see the ads. So I was like frantically trying to look and I couldn't find it. So I'm like texting Alex's assistant, like, can you find this? And mm-hmm. I mean, we were both like, and then I saw the ad and it wasn't the case at all. But she had said that and her campaign had said that. And I thought it was incredibly dishonest. I did not see anything in the ad that I thought was her. I mean, was you know, Adam Schiff promoting the Republican in any way. So right. I don't know. I do know that redistricting. So some people also blame him or blame the situation for her not running for reelection. But as I understand it, there was redistricting in California. Totally Democrat state, pretty fair redistricting, but she was not really going to win. She had no chance of winning. Orange County, it's becoming more red. And also just the way they redrew the lines, like she wasn't going to win. So that's really kind of why I think it's not why she was running for Senate, but I think it's why she's not running for reelection. It was kind of like, burn the boats, we're going to do this. And it didn't work out. I'm sure there are a lot of really, you know, strong emotions around it, but you're right. Word choice matters, and we have to be careful about that. And I just don't think we should ever, as Democrats, say anything about elections being rigged, and unless it's true. But even then, like, let's find different words, Democrat
words. That's in different words. And also, if you had a sense that you were not going to win, you always, you know, you might not actually even write an acceptance speech. You'd write a concession speech, and it would be in advance. So the fact that this morning she had to pop out a little apology that went all over in the media, I thought was, she's a woman I've had tremendous amount of respect for. And this made me think, is either someone trying to undermine her or is she just really
having some feelings? Yeah, I have to say, I had all those same thoughts. I also think it'll kind of go away. I mean, I think most people didn't know about it and it'll, you know, and I think she can go on to do good things and be, you know, very helpful in the future. And she is a public servant. And but it's sad to see some of the posts about her on social media because I don't think that it's really representative of who she is or her body of work. So it's a good lesson, though. I've thought about it a lot today. Just in like, I'm like, you really do have to be careful because you don't want that to be, you know, something that your reputation takes a hit because of that, which probably happens to me like on a daily basis, but whatever.
I think it happens even on a, on any level that you're at, you're always at risk of saying something that doesn't come out quite right. Two other questions for you before we all have to go off into the in the long run, more important than Katie Porter using the wrong word. But one is, many people have been picking on the New York Times lately as one example, but the New York Times has been the biggest focus of the New York Times not giving a fair shake to and having very biased take on the election season that we are in right now. And I wondered what your thoughts were on it. You talked in one of your Substacks and the same one about the daydreaming about clicks. And I just, it was such an important reminder. Even I, who talks about clicks and the need to get them all the time, didn't really put it all into context. So help us out here.
Yeah, I mean, you teach journalism, so you know about this a lot more than me. But I don't like the term end stage capitalism, mostly because I don't understand it. But you know, it is this idea that everything that we do that should make a ton of money. And I remember my hometown newspaper. The Edmond Sun in Edmond, Oklahoma, they also had their own printing press, but it was a huge scandal. I think it was in high school or something because someone let it be known that at night they also printed pornographic magazines or materials. But what they were doing was just, you know, maximizing their sunk cost of the printing equipment that they had. Just like when you go to Costco and you buy like the Kirkland brand paper towels, it's probably made at the same place as like name brand paper towels that you buy. And certainly that's the case for like their detergent. It's made, you know, right by Tide, just they put a different label on it. So, and this is like something, you know, people do if they have manufacturing equipment. They want it running all the time. So, but when we put these, so I think it's like two sides of the same coin. I think it's that a lot of hometown newspapers and hometown publications and local publications don't have the ability, you know, to print locally, and the costs go up. And nope, a lot of people aren't doing this anymore. So anyway, you just have this situation where people aren't becoming like, you know, literate on a very basic level. So, and now with the invent of the internet and the proliferation of news online, you have a situation where they're also finally, it's been a long time coming, but they're also falling victims to this situation of people don't want to pay for news and they don't know what to do. But like the New York Times, they could make, and this is the other, sorry, I'm not being very clear, but this is the other side, I think, for journalism. Like maybe it's not a business where you're going to make tons and tons of money, whether you're a journalist or you're a publisher, like you, maybe you're not going to become a millionaire. But you know, you can live a comfortable, steady job. And I would say that's something that's lacking in our society. It's just like this, like comfortable, steady job where you, you know, again, you're never going to be
rich. For journalists.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and so like, it's kind of accepted for journalists, but I think for the publisher, there's been so many, you know, new sites that sell, and the person who is running them makes millions, if not billions of dollars, if it's something unique. But so you see that, I think that's like the late stage capitalism type thing, is people are just have unrealistic expectations. And so you have like all this stuff all at once, and it's not sustainable. But the New York Times, like, so if I click on a story, because no, they don't care if I like it or not like it. I'm clicking it, and they're getting the same amount of money whether I like it or not. So if they say something bad about President Biden, I might just click on it because I'm like, how dare they? And I already subscribe or whatever. I don't anymore, but I used to. So, and it's not going to like count against me as like things that I, you know, the free views or whatever. But so if they print something good about President Biden, I'm going to read it. But a Trump supporter is not going to read it. But you know what a Trump supporter will read? The bad stuff about President Biden. So now they've gotten clicks from both sides. Again, the algorithm doesn't know. The people who are monitoring how many clicks their advertisements that is also on there, that doesn't know. So, and you know, you think about it, like no one is able to, it's really hard for advertising right now. It's hard for publishers. They used to publish, advertise books in the New York Times, which is like not a thing anymore. It's not how books are sold, but no one knows how to sell books anymore. They don't know where to advertise in order to sell books. So it's this huge thing, and people are trying to figure it out, but we're building the plane while we're, you know, flying it.
Yeah.
And it has become such a massive problem. My prediction, I know nothing, so this is probably like, this is like Nostradamus predicting something like, you know, 3,000 years in advance.
We're still talking about Nostradamus.
We are. My prediction is that after the election, there's going to be a lot of right sizing on this, but until then, we're just going to complain about it a lot. But you do have to be careful. And I know some lovely people who write for the New York Times and do incredible work. They're dedicated journalists. But absolutely, they're alongside people who are trying to write stories so that a headline can be written that gets the maximum number of clicks and views.
And it may not even be the journalist who writes the story to get the maximum number of clicks.
Yeah.
It's coming from on high, you know, saying, let's write the headline this way. It's very dangerous.
It's so dangerous. That was like a very inarticulate answer. I'm sorry. But I mean, the bottom line
is,
I think we have to look at where journalism is on a local level and, you know, recognize the damage that has been created by the erosion of that. Mm-hmm. But we also have to be careful to say, I don't have a hometown newspaper anymore. I really want to read a newspaper. I'm still going to stick with this. New York Times, Washington Post, whatever. I actually still subscribe to Washington Post. But you have to think, like, are you part of the problem if you're supporting it with your dollars? Okay. I say that as someone whose husband is still on Twitter, and I'm really not an active Twitter user anymore. I do understand. But, I mean, there are all these decisions we're having to make about the cost-benefit analysis of these things. But what, if any, damage are they doing as well? And it's a personal decision. I'm not going to, like, you know, really judge someone for the decision they make, but I think we should be informed consumers and realize that we are giving them something in exchange, and maybe we are inadvertently supporting the thing which we don't support at all.
Right. And then it puts, yeah, and my only concern is that it puts things like the New York Times between a real rock and a hard place, because they do need to make money. And if we're pulling our money away from them, mm-hmm. I think the thing that I object to is just the kind of condescending tone of, was it which Sulzberger, but one of them who sort of said something like, you know, we know our jobs and you don't, sort of thing. It's mm-hmm. like, mm-hmm. no, that's actually not what's happening here. If you were, you know, I think we'd all prefer if they were honest about the need to get the clicks mm-hmm. that they need to get.
And it may be a situation where it's a better conversation that we could have in person, or that I could listen to a panel of someone, of a journalist asking him questions. Like, I'd love to hear you interview someone and ask them these questions straight on, but you're reading a product and that is a lot more difficult, or you're seeing them respond on social media, which is also very one-dimensional, and maybe we could understand it better, but that's not a conversation we're having, which makes it difficult. Because it's not a conversation we're having, and it's just them responding. But in the way it's being presented right now, there is a tremendous amount of condescension.
Yes, and it's not a good way to get readers on your side or anybody. I don't know if condescension has ever worked. Has it ever, Rachel dear? Has it ever worked for you? She said in a condescending tone. One quick. It's not quick, but one conversation I want to have with you before we have to run off into the night. Mm-hmm. And that is your latest Suburban Women Problem podcast. And let me just say also that I love your podcast for a lot of reasons, but one is that on the homepage of your podcast, it has the quote from Lindsey Graham, Mr. Mashed Potato Mouth himself, mm-hmm. talking about the Suburban Women Problem, where you got the name. It just makes me very happy.
The Republicans have a Suburban Women Problem. They have since 2018.
And it hasn't gone away, has it?
That has not gone away. They have not even tried.
Would you say that what would you say the situation between this, how the Suburban Women Problem looks for this election year versus 4 years ago?
It's even more precarious because, as it turns out, suburban women, like women everywhere, really do like to make their own decisions about their lives and their bodies. And they want their daughters to be able to do the same. So they don't seem to have learned this lesson or figured this out, which, I mean, I know a lot of times we celebrate this as like it's an in, but it also keeps me awake at night a lot because a lot of people are suffering in the meantime until we can right the ship and, you know, kind of correct our course. And there's a lot of people who a lot of harm has been done. So it is critical. I mean, in addition to, I feel like the safety and security of my own family from a very practical point, but there is the safety and security of women and girls and people who identify as trans or gay and other marginalized people all over our country whose futures are in jeopardy. And so I think about myself because that's what we do as humans, but it is never far from my mind, the repercussions for everyone else who doesn't enjoy the same amount of support that we do from so many, and we feel that support. But I think about the people who don't feel that support and who don't know what to do when they have a pregnancy that needs to end in order to save their life. And how are they going to do this? And who is caring about them? Because like, maybe they can't go on social media and have, you know, kind mm-hmm. words said to them.
Or yeah. travel so, 700 miles to go to where they need to go, or whatever yeah, these things are, yeah. or even know that there's any support mm-hmm. out there.
Right. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Just on a, before we go on a very sad note, one of my students, last week, who is a trans man, committed suicide. Mm-hmm.
I'm so sorry.
Person was an activist, who seemed to have, you know, a keen understanding of everything that was going on in the trans world and was fighting for mm-hmm. trans and LGBTQ plus rights. And, you know, I don't know the reasons, obviously, but I understand that he was overwhelmed by what happened with Next Benedict and what happened just in general, the lack of the support that they yes. saw out there and that many people mm-hmm. see or don't mm-hmm. see. And yeah. it is heartbreaking. And it's heartbreaking to have had it happen to this kid who really was creating change. Mm-hmm. And had a vision for the future and became overwhelmed by what's going on in the world.
Thank you for sharing that story, because I think that is, you know, the important part is to share those stories that this is happening and this is what, you know, part of what we have to protect and part of why we do what we do. And you know how hard it is. Like, it does take an emotional toll on you to be out mm-hmm. there, to be on social media, to do these things, to share your story, to tell mm-hmm. other people's stories, all those things. It is, if you are any kind of empathetic person, anywhere on the spectrum, right. it is really hard. And we have to offer support, I think, to those people who are doing those things, which is like often all of us, you know, but we have to say, I recognize what you're doing and I know it's hard. Someone said this to me just last week and it really was meaningful. And when we have to do that, to say, I know it must take an emotional toll, but like going back to, we have to go back to that place of how awful it was, like every freaking day of the Trump presidency. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be hard, but we have to go back and remember that those things that we, for very good reason, want to block out, but we can't, because right. we have to remember how horrible it was to maybe motivate us to do more, but also to say, this is why we fight. This is what we're doing. Speaking of Substack, Reed Galen had an amazing post this week about this is why we fight. And I thought it was just, it was so beautiful. Like, this is why we all need to do this work. And your student is young and, you know, we all know that things are harder, you know, when we're younger and yeah. we need to talk to the young people. yes. So, but we need to let them know we're doing this for them. We're doing it with them. And we are all in this fight together, and what they're doing means a lot to us. And we just want to be there helping them and them helping us. It's going to be a long fight. It's 8 months. It's going to be hard, but yep. We have to lean on each other and really, you know, kind of lean into that.
Absolutely. And show support. I think what you said about, you know, just saying to somebody that, you know, is working hard for anything, something to show them your support is really, really important. Because you never know what somebody's going through. I know it sounds yeah. trite, but after this past couple of weeks, it's really, really true.
So it takes so long sometimes to see the change, to see what you, and I think also when you're younger, it takes, it's also hard. It, change always doesn't look like what you think it's going to look like. You don't always get that reaction that you think you're going to get. And so that's right. Another thing. And I'm close with some young activists and I try to remind them of that, is it's not always going to look like it, but it doesn't mean that things aren't happening. Things aren't changing. It's just, you're not seeing it right now, but what you're doing is meaningful. And we need to remind people that don't have as much life experience as, you know, the two of us who have birthdays this month on the same day, March 25th.
yes, everybody. You
know, people who don't have as many birthdays behind them, we have to remind them that, you know, because we can't let them get burned out. They are our future and our hope, and they're working really hard too. And we need to give them some encouragement.
Right. And they're working hard against things that we've messed up, you know, and we can talk about, let's all remember what a terrible 4 years it was with Trump. Well, the truth is we still have the repercussions of Trump right here. And we don't have time to talk about the judgeships and, oh yes, the Supreme Court and et cetera, that still have beyond impact on us today.
Yep, it's true. Well, they were like in middle school and I wasn't engaged enough to go work and because I thought Hillary would just win and I didn't do anything. And that's not their fault. That's my fault. That's my generation for not seeing the signs and doing more. And that is what we have to fight against this year. Atone of some sort.
Yeah, I agree. And if anybody needs help, any LGBTQ plus people out there, transgender, the Trevor Project is out there for you. And please reach out to them. That's what I have to say. Even if you don't think you need a complete help, just go for it. Just give them a call.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for being here. And setting our daydreaming straight. We're going to go ahead, you know, straight ahead. Let's just
Save your daydreaming for I don't know, a trip you want to take to the beach or something.
Right. Or what kind of birthday cake I want or whatever. Right. And instead, and full speed ahead. And thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Marissa. This is lovely. Always great to talk to you.
Thank you for joining us today. The Trevor Project can be reached by texting 678-678. And if you're able, please donate at thetrevorproject.org. Please follow and subscribe to Rachel Vindman's newsletter at rachelvindman.substack.com and listen to her on the Suburban Women's podcast. You can also find me at marissarothkoff.substack.com and follow the Deep State Radio on social media. And please, take care of yourself. Thank you.